This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump said on Twitter today that the United States military will be striking Syria, writing that missiles, quote, will be coming, nice and new and smart. Vladimir Putin's spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, on the other hand, said, quote, we don't participate in Twitter diplomacy. We advocate serious approaches. That's the view from the Russians. Now, the president's tweets follow a suspected chemical weapons attack in the rebel-held city of Duma on Saturday. Both Syrian state news and the Russian foreign ministry have denied that a suspected chemical weapons were launched by the Syrian government. But what are the Trump administration's options if the president decides to launch a strike in Syria? Well, joining me now is James DeVritis. He's the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also a retired naval admiral who served as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. Admiral DeVritis, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
First of all, let me lean on your military experience here and ask you, if you were at the president's side right now, what would you be advising him on Syria?
I would tell him to go in with manned airstrikes, Meghna. In other words, about a year ago, we had a chemical attack. We used Tomahawk missiles. Those are unmanned, very low risk. We sent a signal. Did not work. Next step on the ladder of escalation is to use manned aircraft, which can carry very heavy bombs. We ought to use those Tomahawks initially as a wave to knock down the anti-air war defense systems in Syria, then send the manned aircraft in. That's higher risk. There are pilots, brave American men and women flying those aircraft. But I think the chemical attacks are real, and I think they demand a significant response.
Okay, but I think we've already seen Russia say they're vowing to shoot down any and all missiles, U.S. missiles, fired at Syria. So you would put troops potentially in the line of fire then?
That's what our Department of Defense is paid to do. And first of all, the Russian claims that they will shoot down everything that fly over Syria is not realistic from a military perspective. They have significant capability, but we are very, very good at this. We may or may not take some losses, but certainly our troops are combat ready. And again, the situation, in my view, demands a military response, and it is entirely warranted under international law.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis just said today, though, that the United States and its allies are still assessing the intelligence around this suspected attack. He didn't come out and say that the Trump administration believes conclusively that it was the Syrian government, though. But so first of all, your response to that?
First of all, I would say that we are in possession of significant intelligence, which points definitively in that direction. Secondly, we would not launch those strikes unless we had that intelligence. So this will be the proof is in the pudding, or in this case, in the strike, so to speak. What Secretary Mattis is saying is we will continue to analyze, but at the same time, Meghna, he is building those strike plans, putting those forces on alert, moving an aircraft carrier into the Mediterranean, and preparing for combat.
Can you tell me more about what that intelligence is?
I would not want to share classified information, but I think the level of discussion, for example, by our excellent United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley, by the president's tweets, which are crude and inflammatory, but they certainly would say to me that he has been thoroughly briefed on the intelligence.
Just to continue on this track a little bit, forgive me, Dean Stavridis, but are you saying that you have been privileged to some of this intelligence around this latest attack in Syria?
No, okay. I am saying that I am drawing, I think, an entirely logical conclusion based on 37 years in the military.
Right.
And operating at the highest levels.
Okay. I just wanted to ask because, I mean, I presume we have discussed before how obviously because of your experience, you know many of the men and women at those highest levels of government and the military today. So I just didn't know if you'd had any conversations along that front. But about the fact that you believe this is a warranted escalation, if indeed the United States decides to attack Syria, doesn't that get straight to the heart of the Syria conundrum right now? And I'm I'm saying this because just today in the New York Times, Max Fisher wrote a really interesting column where he said U.S. options include limited airstrikes. Not sure at what cost that would exact on Bashar al-Assad. Arming rebels, which was the option that the Obama administration seemed to take, or a full-scale invasion. But what he pointed out was that the problem with all three of these options is a structural one, in that Russia and Iran are already deeply involved. So escalation is a dangerous thing because Russia and Iran could just as well escalate in return.
Absolutely correct. And that is the risk. I am less concerned about Iran, who has less capability to really embroil the United States by themselves in a significant global conflict. I am very concerned, as anybody ought to be, with the possibility of this kind of strike causing collateral damage that kills Russians. So what we should be doing, Meghna, is communicating to Russia, and I'm certain we are doing this, again, based on my experience, communicating to Russia, not with precise times or locations, but simply making them aware that to the degree their forces are closely intertwined physically with the Syrian forces, they are at risk. And I think you will see Russia, for example, get their ships underway and get out of Syrian ports. That's a fact. That's already happened. And so I think that Russia has no more of a desire to escalate this than we do. And they will bluster and they will pay lip service to the idea that, oh, we stand with our Syrian allies. And I suppose they do in the broader sense. But they have no desire to see a couple of Tomahawk missiles take out a couple of hundred Russians. And I think in that sense, telegraphing to them that they need to be careful about where their forces are located makes a lot of sense.
Admiral Stavridis, I have to say that hearing you say that manned U.S. airstrikes in Syria is now warranted or may now be warranted is more hawkish than I anticipated you saying. I mean, what's different now than in April 2017?
Indeed. I have always been one, and you know this well from all of our conversations, to reach for the soft power instrument.
Right.
But I have always said there are times when you need hard power. And the Assad regime, not only in this incident, Meghna, but in a half a dozen instances now, going back a year or two, continues to use chemical weapons on innocent women and children. That is unconscionable. And I believe it not only warrants, but I believe it demands an international response. I would love to see the Israelis, the French, the British, and I believe other nations will ultimately sign on to this. I do not advocate invading Syria. I do not advocate 150,000 troops there like we had in Iraq at one point. I do not advocate going to war with Russia about this, but I do advocate a smart but significant strike that takes out Syrian military capability that is used to perpetuate these kind of chemical attacks.
I have to say, I think a lot of people hearing this might understandably be feeling a sense of caution about this, and rightly so, because we're talking about escalation. It makes me wonder, are we at a tipping point, though, that if we have... Okay, this is your suggestion. Just I want to remind everyone your thoughts, not necessarily what the Trump administration or General Mattis have said yet. But I mean, I'm just wondering, are we at the possible tipping point where we go from a proxy war in Syria to a hotter war between the United States and Russia there?
I think that is a very, very low possibility. First, because it's in neither interest of the United States nor Russia. Secondly, because our combat lethality and precision is quite good, and we can use these strikes in a sensible way to hit back at the facilities, the kill chain that has produced these chemical attacks. And thirdly, because as I look at the battlefield and the battle space, there is very low likelihood of an escalation in force beyond these strikes. A good analogy, Magda, is to look back at the Balkans in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. We conducted quite a few manned aircraft strikes, and eventually that brought parties to the table. And in the end, that's what settled the Balkans. It was that mix of hard power at the front end moving to diplomacy at the back end. But that's what we can hope for here.
To the point, though, I mean, that was with in concert with allies.
And with Russia, ultimately, and that's worth remembering in the Balkans. So these things have to start, and I think it is in nobody's interest to simply let this chemical incident dangle in the wind. We ought to conduct a strike, take out Syrian capability, hope that can be leveraged diplomatically with Russia, for example, and with our allies to come to the table. And none of this ought to be presumed to be an attractive set of options. But again, to me, the higher risk is simply walking away and saying, it's okay to use chemical weapons. That does not lead the world in a good direction.
So one last question for you, Admiral, if I may. As in the past, you and I have spoken about the National Security Advisor because it was General H.R. McMaster, whom you know. I'm just wondering, since he has stepped down from that position, have you had a chance to talk with him?
Coincidentally, I chatted with him this morning for about half an hour, congratulating him on his work in, for example, creating the new national security strategy, and congratulating him on his integrity in a very hard position, and telling him I'm here to help in any way I can as he transitions to civilian life.
Are you able to tell us anything about insights he might have given you about the president?
I think I'll let those conversations stand between myself and General McMaster. I will tell you that he has a very bright future, and we will hear more from General McMaster. He will tell his own story in time.
And finally, what's your view on John Bolton, the new National Security Advisor? I mean, many people see him as being the most hawkish choice that the president could have made.
I think that is absolutely correct. And I'm also concerned, unlike General McMaster, who's famous for building teams and collegial working environment, National Security Advisor Bolton is someone who is famous for being extremely difficult to work with. I think that'll be a problem as he tries to move the interagency coherently together. I think General McMaster did a good job of building teams. I'm less sanguine about that possibility with John Bolton.
So it sounds like you're worried about John Bolton having the president's ear.
I think that John Bolton historically has always reached for the instrument of hard power. And I think that it is unfortunate that the first thing that comes under his direction as an interagency process is one in which hard power actually makes sense, because I think that will simply strengthen his view that the military instrument is the right one. As you and I have talked about many times, it is so often the wrong one. But in this case, I think it's time to launch that strike.
Well, James Stavridis is the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a retired naval admiral and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. Admiral Stavridis, thank you as always.
Always a pleasure, and wonderful questions, Magna. Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
So I just heard that they broke into the office of one of my personal attorneys, good man, and it's a disgraceful situation. It's a total witch hunt. I've been saying it for a long time.
That, of course, is President Trump reacting on Monday to news that the FBI had raided the Manhattan office, hotel room, and home of Michael Cohen, President Trump's personal attorney. On Tuesday, the president continued on Twitter saying, quote, attorney-client privilege is dead. Well, let's get some analysis from WBUR's legal analyst and retired federal judge, Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
So is attorney-client privilege dead?
It's not remotely dead. Certainly, this is a raid that is concerning. One, since we don't know what was in the affidavit in support of the search warrant, which is sealed, we don't necessarily know the grounds for it. But there certainly are circumstances under which a lawyer's office can be searched, very narrow circumstances, got to be lots of approvals. But it is not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Okay, so about those approvals, I mean, this is a raid on a lawyer's office. And I just wonder, I mean, given the sacrosanct nature of attorney-client privilege, what levels of approval had to be secured before this raid could happen?
Well, there are two things. One is that the levels of approval is that you had to get the head of the criminal division of the Department of Justice, apparently, at least from the reporting, Rosenstein also signed off on this. And then because the issues concerned a matter that in fact was not within the purview of Mueller's investigation,
Yes. It
was turned over to the Southern District of New York, where the head of that office, who was a Trump appointee, recused himself. So this was now conducted by the public corruption unit of the Southern District and the FBI. And then a magistrate approved it, found probable cause to believe that there was illegality in Cohen's office.
Okay. So about that Southern District of New York referral.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that this isn't related to Mueller's investigation.
Well,
it
means that the reason for the raison d'etre, the reason for going into Cohen's office, home, and hotel room was related to a Southern District prosecution. Now, there's no question that if they come up with something in the course of that, if they stumble on something that's not otherwise privileged that relates to the Mueller investigation, they certainly could go forward. It's like I search your house for bank fraud and I find your cocaine stash. I don't go, sorry, I'm here on for one purpose. I can't look at another. But nevertheless, it's focused on what looks like, at least if the reporting is right, bank fraud. It's focused on wire fraud. And there was also some reference in one of the reporting to Cohen's, taxi medallion business, which, of course, has nothing to do with the attorney-client privilege.
Okay. So about that potential bank and wire fraud, would this be – I mean, we're seeing reporting that said the agents were looking for records possibly connected to payments to two women in connection with Donald Trump.
Right. If Cohen, now apparently the president says that Cohen did this on his own, was making these payments in order to silence women, which in order to protect the president, that would be arguably a campaign violation, for the federal election law campaign violation, for which he is not protected as an attorney. There was also some suggestion that the way the payments were made may have run afoul of bank regulations, that two of the banks who were involved actually had filed what's called a suspicious activity report on them. So the way in which it is done is not privileged. It can't be, in cash in a bag on the corner. The way in which it was done was not privileged and has nothing to do with the privilege. The fact of the payment, given what the president said, may have nothing to do with the privilege either.
Okay. So one more question about the specifics around the FBI raid. There's been a lot of discussion about clean teams and taint teams.
Doesn't that sound wonderful?
What does all this mean?
Well, it's a contrivance, and it's the following contrivance. You walk into a lawyer's office. The lawyer's office may have a pot of files that are entirely protected by the lawyer-client privilege and others that are not, the kinds of things that I was describing. But you sweep up everything. There's not a file that says attorney-client privilege. There are files. So what happens is that the Department of Justice creates a group, puts together a group that is unrelated to the investigation, that has nothing to do with the investigation, not allowed to talk to the investigators for the purposes of sorting out what may well be privileged information from what is not. It is a tremendously risky enterprise. One has to risky enterprise in this for this reason. If they happen to include in the mix something that is privileged, and there are prosecutions of Cohen or anybody else, there will be substantial litigation about the inappropriateness of the search. So before you step into a lawyer's office, and particularly the lawyer to the president, one would only hope that some care was taken in determining what the information was on which to search.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because on Fox News, Harvard Law School professor emeritus Alan Dershowitz has been saying that this search was executed based only on probable cause, and so therefore he does believe it's a violation of attorney-client privilege.
That doesn't make any sense. A lawyer, there's privileged communications, but there's also things that you may tell a lawyer that has nothing to do with the privilege. In fact, there's a wonderful line in the in an article in the New York Times about how John Gotti basically told federal prosecutors that his lawyer represented him on everything as a way of sort of shielding everything. So the lawyer-client privilege can be with respect to matter A, but not with respect to matter B, not with respect to like Ukrainian payments for videos. Right? I mean, so that's one question. And presumably this would be probable cause for the non-privileged information. In addition, you can't use a lawyer and your communications with a lawyer to effect an ongoing fraud.
Okay.
So there's a thing called the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. You can't make use of your lawyers and the privilege that comes with that for the purpose of perpetrating an ongoing fraud. And so one theory here is that this was a federal elections fraud for which Trump was using Cohen. So Professor Dershowitz, with all due respect, if this was a search warrant for only privileged information, it would be one thing. But this is a search warrant, presumably, none of us know, fashioning probable cause for the non-privileged and crime fraud exceptions of the Cohen office. And if they manage to follow that line, there's nothing wrong with it.
Well, Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. I suppose in a roundabout way, this time we did kind of talk about Stormy Daniels. Judge Gertner, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Day two of Mark Zuckerberg's testimony before Congress. Yesterday, the Facebook CEO appeared before the Joint Senate Judiciary and Commerce Committees, and today he took questions from the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And the tone is less deferential than we heard from the Senate yesterday. Here's Congressman Kurt Schrader, Oregon Democrat, challenging Zuckerberg's claim that Facebook doesn't sell users' data.
But it's pretty clear others do sell that information. Doesn't that make you somewhat complicit in what they're doing? You're allowing them to sell the information that they glean from your website?
Well, Congressman, I would disagree that we allow it. We actually expressly prohibit any developer that people
choose to share their information. How do you enforce that? That's my concern. How do you enforce that? Complaint only is what I've heard so far tonight.
That was from the House today. Joining me now is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. He questioned Mark Zuckerberg at the Senate hearing yesterday. Senator Markey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So did you come away from what you heard Mark Zuckerberg tell you yesterday satisfied or frustrated?
Well, I heard contrition from Mark Zuckerberg yesterday, but what I wanted to hear about was permission, that is, a commitment to obtaining the kind of clear permission that should be required under law before any user's information is shared or sold by Facebook. And I was very disappointed because first I asked him about having a law that would affect adults and children to make sure that that was the standard, that explicit permission had to be received. And I did not get that commitment. And then I just asked him about 13, 14, and 15-year-olds, mm-hmm. that permission be received from their parents before their information is shared or sold. And again, I got no commitment. So the point of the hearing is a privacy invasion of Americans. So the answer has to be with regard to that issue and studying it, or I'll get back to you, or, you know, let's have a conversation about it after, you know, plenty of time to think about it. Sorry just isn't a good enough answer.
Right. And so, but on the other hand, Zuckerberg did say that, you know, they're taking steps in Europe as required by the Europeans, and that some of those options might be available here in the United States. Does that satisfy you?
Well, that's the question. Europe now has a standard which is going to be implemented on May 25th, which is a broad opt-in, ask for permission standard. And Facebook is going to have to comply with that standard. And so isn't Google. So isn't every other company which is American, which is doing business in Europe. So the question is, are American adults and children going to get the same protections that the Europeans are going to provide? And he wouldn't say that it would be the same.
Mm.
And he would not tell us where he differed with the Europeans, what part of the European privacy protections he thinks are not appropriate for the United States children and adults.
I guess the question is now, I mean, look, some 87 million Facebook users had their information used without their knowledge, right? So this is a huge, enormous scale we're talking about here. A lot of folks may be wondering, okay, Mark Zuckerberg's testifying before the Senate and the House, but what's going to come of all this? I mean, you know, is there an appetite in Congress to take meaningful steps to regulate Facebook?
Well, again, Senator Blumenthal, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, and I introduced a privacy bill of rights called the Consent Act yesterday. And it's going to require companies like Facebook and Google to obtain opt-in permission from users to use, share, or sell users' personal information. Now, we're in for a mighty struggle because
right.
It's pretty clear that these companies still aren't stepping up and saying that they will do it voluntarily on the one hand or accept regulation on the other. And in that regulatory black hole are all of the financial, personal data of every American, where there is no clear protection which is put on the books or implemented by companies. And it just can't be one company. It has to be every company that's online that's providing this privacy bill of rights. So I think we're in for a mighty struggle, but I think we've reached the watershed moment. I think that the day of reckoning has arrived, and it's going to happen now, sooner or later. Because every new story is going to increase the momentum, the intensity of interest
yeah.
in this issue. America just went through a one-month tutorial on how their privacy is compromised. And right now, there are still no answers that are coming from Facebook or anyone else.
Senator, while I've got you, I want to just turn briefly to Syria, because as you, of course, know, President Trump has tweeted this morning that get ready, Russia, because they, meaning missiles, will be coming nice and new and smart. We don't yet know with any greater specificity if the Trump administration has decided to do an airstrike in Syria, but if they do, would you support that?
Well, I want the president to articulate comprehensive strategy for dealing with Syria. You know, one day he's saying he's going to pull out the troops. The next day he's saying that he's going to be bombing. And that just sends such mixed signals to the world, but especially to those combatants in Syria, that it's pretty much incomprehensible. So obviously, larger scale and longer duration attacks require congressional authorization, which he does not have. And he still hasn't held the Russians to account, because the Russians made promises. They promised they would rid Syria of chemical weapons. They promised they would allow unfettered humanitarian access, that they would help to enforce a ceasefire, that they would ensure that Assad goes to the negotiating table. None of that has happened, and the president has not held Vladimir Putin accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So this disconnect that the president has in terms of his actions in Syria, ultimately creates an environment wherein the Iranians, but the Russians are able to still play games there in coordination with Assad. And so it's just time for the president to articulate what he's going to extract from the Russians and what he's willing to do to the Russians, because they are not, in fact, doing what it is that they promised to do.
Senator, if I just may, because we just got about 30 seconds left here, if the president did indeed do that, further articulate those plans or intentions, as you said, wouldn't that possibly, I don't know, diminish the potency of an airstrike if he also wants to do that?
Well, he's already telegraphed that he's going to attack. So that's a fact. But we already did the same thing. He already did the same thing
last year.
Back last year. So if his goal, you know, is to get a result here, then there has to be some kind of coordination, because right now the last attack, it turns out, was neither operationally nor strategically successful. The Syrian Air Force was soon flying again. Assad continued to use chemical weapons. So what's going to be different this time?
Right.
Well, I would say what should be different is that he's engaging Congress in a debate, and he's engaging the Russians in finding a way to use diplomacy to resolve this issue.
Well, that's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Senator Markey, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.